1 o'clock.
This is the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Hurricane Dorian has been getting stronger, slowing down, and its predicted path has been drifting south, all putting South Florida increasingly at risk as the storm threatens. Gasoline, water, food, we've all been stocking up, bracing for a major storm. The South Florida Water Management District is advising people to make sure drains are clear. Drew Bartlett is the executive director.
And assured that we're going to be there for you, for Florida. Some of this money that's being reprogrammed, I think, had been appropriated long ago and was never spent. I don't know the background to that, but I'm confident that it's not going to impact Florida in a negative way.
Obviously not Drew Bartlett, but that, in fact, was Governor Ron DeSantis talking about the transfer of FEMA money to the Department of Homeland Security that was recently acknowledged by the Trump administration. But the South Florida Water Management District is one of many government agencies, of course, watching the forecast very closely, trying to prepare, clearing out storm water drains for a storm that's expected to dump many inches of water and bring very high and dangerous winds and storm surge into South Florida. 800-743-WLRN. That's our telephone number. Your storm preparation plans. How ready is your neighborhood, your community? What questions do you have about preparing for this major hurricane? 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text at 786-786-7636. Again, text us at 786-786-7636. Kimberly Miller is along with us, a weather reporter, the weather reporter for the Palm Beach Post. She's with us from that newsroom in Palm Beach County. Alex Harris covers the climate for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our studios inside the Miami Herald in Doral. Let's start in Palm Beach County here, Kimberly. What's the forecast for Palm Beach County? Doesn't look good. What's the latest that you're hearing from the National Hurricane Center?
Yeah, I talked to three forecasters this morning, including Ken Graham from the National Hurricane Center, who said that some drops-on data that they collected last night from the hurricane hunters really brought the forecast track models to a better consensus. They had been, you know, more disagreement, and it is looking like a landfall in Palm Beach County or the Treasure Coast at this point. And they seemed pretty confident in that forecast. So I think people are taking this really seriously. They were taking it seriously before now, but I think when you see that skinny black line on top of you, it ramps up the angst a little bit, a lot.
Yeah, a lot, as a matter of fact. Yeah, definitely, Kimberly. What about the timing here for this storm? Because as the forecasters have been mentioning now for the better part of a day, they're expecting it to slow down. And that allows it just to sit over that warm ocean water.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. So, I mean, they're saying off our coast, at 8 a.m. on Monday now, or Monday, and flowing to 4 miles per hour.
Yeah.
Which means we're talking about a Category 4 storm, although Weather Underground was saying Category 3 earlier this morning when it made landfall, with catastrophic winds and dumping, you know, a foot of rain. And these winds would go as far in as Indiantown at Category 3 strength, and then the route right now takes it up to Orlando as a Category 1 hurricane.
Alex Harris, what about the outlook further south there for our listening area in Broward, Dade, and Monroe counties?
I mean, obviously, we are all keeping a very close eye on every single update from the National Hurricane Center. They have, as you said, been drifting south recently, and we don't want to, you know, take our eyes off it or think that we're all clear, because as forecasters keep telling us, we don't know until it gets here. But yes, everyone's making preparations down here. Officials in Monroe, Miami-Dade, and Broward have been getting water ready, getting evacuation orders in order. We're not there yet, but they're starting to talk about what that would look like. Mm-hmm. The state EOC is at full capacity this morning, ready for this storm.
So lots here to talk about, Alex and Kimberly. Let me start, Kimberly, with the real focus of concern, and that being Palm Beach County at this point in that area. We know that Palm Beach County is obviously right on Lake Okeechobee to the west. And the South Florida Water Management District had been bringing down the lake level for many, many weeks prior to storm season. Today, I saw it's just over 13.5 feet. What kind of concern is the lake level, and what about the canal levels there in Palm Beach County?
I know that they are draining the canals right now. They're getting as much water as they can to go south. And we actually have a reporter who is working today specifically on a Lake Okeechobee and the Herbert Hoover Dyke story to see what condition is in. I know it's been hardened. Obviously, there have been improvements since Wilma took chunks of it, you know, out. So I know I'll be embedded with the South Florida Water Management District along with another reporter and a videographer. So we'll be keeping a close eye on that, and we'll be updating our website, palmbeachpost.com, continually with updates just on the forecast and the status of the dike.
Yeah, that's of concern. And another concern, Alex, of course, are the tides here. I think today here on this Friday is a king tide day. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, we're actually in the second king tide of the season, which is one of our annual highest high tides of the year. We're scheduled for about 4, and the peak of it is looking to be Saturday, Sunday right now. So we are not even all the way ramped up yet.
Is that the peak of the storm or the peak of...
I'm sorry, the peak of king tide.
Of king tide, okay.
Right, and we're looking at the storm for Tuesday morning right now with winds getting started on Monday. So, yes, it's definitely a concern. People I've talked to with the Weather Service and the Hurricane Center have all mentioned, you know, tides could be a big element in this for flooding.
And so, Kim, from the water management's point of view, is they're moving water south and potentially east as much as they could, I guess. What kind of challenges does the tide present for them?
Well, I think it's the same thing for us. We're seeing a little bit of street flooding. Obviously, we're not as in bad a condition as Miami and Broward, but I think our coastal or intercoastal residents, at least, are a little bit concerned about seeing the tides with the rain. We had flooding just recently, just from 4 inches of rain, you know, it came at a short period of time. So I think all of this water on top of each other is a big concern. And I mean, winds obviously are incredibly scary, but as we hear over and over again, most people die from the water. And you don't want to be in a car and driving into a flooded roadway. We have cars that get stalled just on a normal afternoon thunderstorm in Palm Beach County, you know, from heavy rainfall. So people should just be really wary of driving anywhere where there's, you know, deep water. Mm-hmm. We don't want anyone getting hurt or drowning just because they needed to get to the store or something.
It's the high water and, of course, not knowing what's in the water or the condition of the roadbed under the water. Alex Harris with the Herald, the king tides in Dade and Broward County, for Palm Beach County, for that matter, all of it, right? It brings up the concern about storm surge timing and really how high, how much. Have we seen much storm surge prediction yet out of the Hurricane Center regarding the storm?
We're not at the point yet where there are predictions for us. I know the Bahamas is looking at 10 to 15 feet of storm surge. We could start seeing those predictions coming up maybe later today, probably closer to this weekend, as we start getting tropical storm and hurricane watch and warnings assigned to the state.
And that could trigger, of course, storm surge evacuation notices as well for folks that are living in South Florida, right, Alex?
Absolutely. And yeah, officials in the state and county levels are already thinking about that and getting ready to make the preparations as needed.
Preparations for Hurricane Dorian here on the South Florida Roundup. Your thoughts, your concerns, your questions as we talk to Kimberly Miller, weather reporter for the Palm Beach Post, Alex Harris, climate reporter for our partner, the Miami Herald. 800-743-9576. That's the voice line, 800-743-WLRN. You can also send us a text. That text line is 786-786-7636. The text line again, 786-786-7636. We'll start in Fort Lauderdale, where Mark is on line one. Go ahead, Mark. Your thoughts?
Hello. How are you?
Doing well. Go ahead. How are you today?
Not to betray my age, but I remember in the 60s, on a regular basis, the coordinates of the storm were given. And I would like, if possible, if that could come back, if you could give the coordinates as a person who is blind, that I could track up much more easily, and I'm sure others also.
Sure, interesting. Right, so you're blind, and you want to know the coordinates. Well, Mark, I pulled them up here from the 11 a.m. advisory. The location of the storm, 24.5 degrees north, 69.8 degrees west. So it is about 480 miles east of the northwestern Bahamas, 660 miles east of West Palm Beach, And it is moving, let's see here, looks like about 10 miles an hour. But Kimberly Miller, as you mentioned, that is expected to slow. That's already a slow-moving storm at 10 miles an hour and expected to slow even further as it approaches the coastline. The danger of that it just compounds all of the concerns around water and wind and storm surge. And how long could that storm sit in that position? We saw the concerns of that around, for instance, Hurricane Harvey in the Houston area.
Sure. I mean, one of the questions I asked the National Hurricane Center this morning is, could this be a Hurricane Florence that approached the coast, as a Cat 3 or 4, slowed down to a Cat 1, it got a lot bigger, so they saw a lot more rain and storm surge. They said no, they are not expecting that. They are expecting a Cat 4 at landfall. They didn't know the size of this, storm. That's really hard to predict. Right now, it's not huge. It's got hurricane force winds, I think, 25 miles per from the center. Tropical storm force was a little over 100 miles, I think, last I checked. But yeah, that slow movement is just, and I think people here are having flashbacks to Frances, where people were stuck inside for 24 hours as its storm just raged over top of us. And that was only a Category 1 when it made landfall. And if we're thinking about a Category 4, this is going to be really serious. We're going to have to really take this seriously.
So what are some of those lessons that could be applicable after that storm that could be applicable for this storm here?
Well, I think people are much better prepared. I mean, in my neighborhood, it seems like everyone has a generator because I don't, and it's hard to sleep at night with it.
That's always the case, right? If you're the one without the generator, it seems like everybody else has one.
Right. But, I mean, the whole state is better prepared. The gas stations have generators. Publix have generators. I mean, this morning, when I went to go get gas, the 87 was gone, but they still had the more expensive gas. And there weren't terribly long lines. So I think people are more storm ready, and especially after Irma, like I said, that was a good dry run for Palm Beach County.
Yeah. Kimberly Miller, Alex Harris, we'll let you guys get back to work. Still lots of work ahead of us, of course. Kimberly Miller, weather reporter for the Palm Beach Post. Thanks for your time and sharing your reporting with us today.
Thank you so much.
Alex Harris, climate reporter with our partner, the Miami Herald. Alex, I'll likely see you out there in Doral over the next several days as we move through the hurricane together. Thanks for sharing your reporting as well.
That's right, everybody. Stay safe. Bye.
Absolutely. We got plenty more to come here on this edition of the South Florida Roundup. We're still going to be talking about the hurricane and preparation, particularly nursing homes and assisted living facilities. How well prepared are they after the tragic consequences that we saw from the power outages at one nursing home in Broward County? That's next on the South Florida Roundup. We're back here on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening and supporting public radio. A different hurricane, Hurricane Irma, struck Broward County as a Category 1 force storm nearly 2 years ago. Some people lost power for up to 10 days. A nursing home in Hollywood lost power. 14 patients, ranging in ages from 71 to 99, died at the rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills from heat-related causes. The Broward County Medical Examiner's Office ruled a dozen of those deaths as homicide. This week, after nearly 2 years of investigation by local, state, and federal agencies, four former employees were criminally charged. The former facility administrator, George Caballo, and former night shift supervisor, Sergio Collin, each face now 12 counts of aggravated manslaughter. Two nurses on duty also charged with aggravated manslaughter, as well as tampering with patient medical records. After the deaths, a new law was put in place that requires nursing homes to have backup power. But many facilities in Florida still don't. When the power goes out, Florida Power and Light restores power based on a priority list. It starts with hospitals and 911 centers. FPL spokesman Tyler Maudlin told WLRN it's on counties to decide what other places get put on that priority list.
It is the responsibility of any facility that is dependent on electricity for the health of its residents to have a backup plan in case of an extended power outage. If you have a loved one in a nursing home or assisted living facility, call that facility and make sure they have a plan that includes backup generation and fuel for the generator, which is required by law.
So what concerns or questions do you have regarding a loved one who may be in a nursing facility, assisted living facility here, as we're facing the threat of a major storm in South Florida? 800-743-9576. That's our voice line, 800-743-9576. Our text line is 786-786-7636. Again, the text line, 786-786-7636. Katie Swatowski covers Broward County for WLRN, and she's with us via Skype. Katie, first of all, tell us about these charges that were filed this week, and after almost 2 years since this tragedy, what led to the charges now?
So Hollywood Police has been working on this investigation, like you were saying, for almost 2 years, and they were working on the investigation with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the state's Agency for Healthcare Administration, and several other state agencies. What they say really was the tipping point for them were the more than 400 hours of video evidence. And so the reason that these charges are aggravated manslaughter instead of just manslaughter, to make that designation, there's got to be vulnerability. So the patients in this case being elderly, mm-hmm. that adds to whatever negligence they're being charged with.
And the case the prosecutors think that they have, what is that, even beyond kind of the video evidence here that led to the charges this week? Very serious charges, obviously, in this tragedy. But what gives the prosecutors confidence?
There are two sides to the story, of mm-hmm. course. And so the prosecutor's side is that there was not enough done and that there was clear and deliberate lack of regard for human life. Now, the defense attorneys for the defendants are saying it's on FPL and former Governor Rick Scott, and mistakes were made by other more higher up agencies.
Former Governor Rick Scott famously said that he had given out his cell phone number on a conference call that was held right before Hurricane Irma with some of the nursing home facilities, right?
Yes, that's right. And there are voicemails from this rehabilitation center in Hollywood Hills to that cell phone number. And we don't know what particular role those will play as this case goes to trial.
And so the investigation up till this point leading to the charges announced this week, the four charges, but the investigation isn't over. The prosecutors had said that they essentially pledged that there were more charges to come. What do we know about that?
So they're really not giving a reason for why this is taking so long, other than it's an incredibly large scale of an investigation for an agency like the Hollywood Police Department to take on. And what they're saying is they are prioritizing accuracy over timeliness, and that they've told all of the victims' family members this, and they're just going to plug on as they can, but that they're anticipating other arrests for sure.
And have they given any sense about whom they may arrest? Is it more employees, more healthcare service workers that were involved, or are we talking up to managers or potentially ownership?
All of the above. Mm. Hollywood Police were really criticized this week for charging, what some people called low-hanging fruit, the caretakers, instead of the managers and the higher-ups at the facility. And so they really didn't say one way or another. It could be anyone that was there at the time or anyone in charge of what was going on at the time.
This tragedy did lead to a new state law that the legislature passed in the wake of Hurricane Irma and the 12 deaths at the Rehabilitation Center in Hollywood. Katie Swatowski is with us covering Broward County. Remind us what that law requires of nursing homes and assisted living facilities.
So bigger facilities are required to have enough fuel to run generators for 72 hours after a storm. Smaller assisted living facilities are only required to have about 48 hours worth of fuel. Nursing homes are also mandated to have equipment that can control their indoor temperatures for 96 hours after a power outage. And they've got to be able to make sure that it doesn't get hotter in there than 81 degrees.
One of those living under those regulations joins us now. Elaine Bloom is with us, the chief executive officer at Plaza Health Network. Elaine, welcome back to WLRN. Thanks for your time today. The Miami Herald has reported 58% of nursing homes in Florida do not have emergency backup power as required by this law as we're facing this hurricane now. About 10% of assisted living facilities don't, according to the Herald reporting. Are your facilities compliant?
Of course. And if I may just put a little bit of context in this, actually for probably about the past 15 years in the state of Florida, all skilled nursing facilities have had to be compliant with having 72 hours worth of backup generator power. The only difference is that it was not required to maintain air conditioning, so that all other kinds of electrical requirements were being met. And I also need to put another context here. The terrible tragedy at Hollywood Hills occurred Tuesday after the Saturday night Sunday hurricane. So this was not occasioned by the same problems that everybody else had to endure with the hurricane. A transformer blew, and it's a terrible story of what happened at Hollywood Hills. But remember, they were next door, truly next door to a hospital. They could have wheeled their patients out of the building and into the hospital.
Well, Elaine, let me have Katie Switalski talk about that, because that's a point that the defense attorneys have brought up here as well, Katie.
And the defense attorneys are saying that the caretakers at Hollywood Hills did everything that they could possibly do. They brought in coolers, they brought in bottled water, but absolutely they did not bring the patients to the hospital until what the prosecution is calling too late.
Elaine, you mentioned about this requirement for skilled nursing facilities. For those of us who may be unfamiliar with the nomenclature here, skilled nursing facilities versus nursing home versus assisted living facilities. Tell us what the difference is.
Skilled nursing homes and what people call nursing homes are the same. Assisted living facilities are totally different. Assisted living facilities, you just have somebody who does not have all the skills, all the activities of daily living, like being able to feed themselves, dress themselves, brush their teeth, whatever it might be. But they can still, in effect, they can go into a car in order to be transported someplace else.
And so, and when you say these facilities have been required to be compliant, what does compliant mean? And not to be argumentative, but just making sure we know what that means. Does it mean they actually have the equipment in place and it's working?
Absolutely. What I'm trying to tell you is that as of Hurricane Irma, only six out of 687 nursing homes in Florida did not have these generators. Only six. They had been grandfathered in when the law was changed about 15 years ago. And all others had to have the generators working for 72 hours. But as I said, they were not required to maintain air-conditioned comfort up to 81 degrees.
That's the new regulation.
The new regulation requires that patients must be in an area where the temperature is 81 degrees or cooler. And so that could be a common area of the building, like a dining room or hallway, or their own rooms. And what we found, and I'm, you know, the point that I'm trying to make is that all but six of the skilled nursing facilities in Florida were compliant. Now the problem is that we were competing with people from all over the country as well as in Florida to get new and additional equipment. In our case, we had to add additional generators so that we could provide the extra electrical energy.
Elaine Bloom is the CEO at Plaza Health Network. Katie Switalski is along with us as well, our Broward County reporter here at WLRN, speaking about nursing homes and assisted living facilities preparations and compliant with some new regulations, a new regulation that was significantly put in place after Hurricane Irma regarding cooling. 800-743-9576. If you have a loved one in a facility, work in a facility, what are your questions here as we head into the final few days of storm preparation for a hurricane? 743-9576, 800-743-9576. Elaine, let me ask you about kind of how the state is communicating this to the public. The state lists online that the number of homes that have implemented the equipment, the number of homes that have been granted an extension, and then indicates that 100% are in compliance. But isn't there, I mean, from a user standpoint, there's a significant difference between having the equipment in place, especially at a time like this, and having a loved one in a facility that's been granted an extension, isn't there?
Yep, no, because the extension means that you've provided some kind of temporary resource to accomplish the same thing. I'm paying the $6,000 a month for a number of extra generators in order while we're waiting for the new enhanced version to come from wherever the manufacturer is. And during the past 2 years, or a year and and a half since we started getting all the details. Well, let me put it this way. How easy it is to dig a hole in your backyard and put a fuel tank in. You know how many different places you have to go to get.
I hear you, and I want to ask you about those things, but I want to get back to this the number of homes implementing the regulation, the number of homes that are granted an extension. So to be granted an extension,
you have to have some temporary generator on site
that fulfills the obligation for the 96 hours of cooling.
Correct.
And oftentimes that's going to be a temporary generator. Or some kind of cooling element.
It could be a rented generator.
Sure.
You know, you lease it.
Yeah.
But the point is, this is a very, very expensive proposition, and all owners are competing with each other.
Yeah.
And the few engineers and surveyors who we have available to do this very specialized work. It's not been easy to get everybody all together, aside from getting all the paperwork that you need and the approvals from the various
the permitting process. With all that consideration, Elaine, you know the regulatory process very, very well. You know the legislative process very, very well. As you reflect back here on this, was this regulation ill-advised given the problems implementing it?
No, I think it was done with the goodness of heart that the legislature wanted to assure that we provide even extra beneficial care to our patients and residents. But remember that we're dealing in skilled nursing facilities with people who are subacute and people who are unable to take care of themselves, people who've just come out of hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
One of the main issues that you and I spoke about almost 2 years ago
mm-hmm.
was that Florida Power and Light, for example, does a wonderful job of providing us all electricity, but some of us feel that just as hospitals are put online right away and emergency facilities, that skilled nursing facilities should be part of that whole scope right afterwards. And skilled nursing facilities tend to be located near major thoroughfares in order for the employees to be able to get utilize public transportation so that we would feel that there should be a means for the power company to make it more easily accessible.
Elaine, let me bring Katie Swatowski back into this piece of the conversation regarding power. One of the many lessons out of Hurricane Irma was the lesson of these priority lists that are put together that FPL uses in order to kind of focus resources early on during these big power outages about where and whom gets power back first. What more do we know about this, especially as we're, you know, looking at obviously a major storm that is going to likely have some impact in Broward County and Palm Beach County, definitely?
Absolutely. Well, I know, so right before hurricane season kicked off this summer, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz held a huge hurricane briefing at the Broward Emergency Operations Center with FPL and county officials for Broward. And at that meeting, as hurricane season was kicking off, there was a huge debate about this because FPL's position as of May 30th was we are not putting nursing homes on our priority list. Broward County's position was we have been begging you to put our nursing homes on our county priority list. Now, this week, reaching back out to both of them, Broward County says they still consider nursing homes a priority. FPL will not say. They consider it customer information that they can't divulge whether or not nursing homes are included. However, their advice is really to reach out, you know, putting it on the individual counties, putting it back on Broward County and back on individuals to say, hey, call facilities if you've got a loved one here and check up on it.
So, Elaine, you've got to be party of those discussions running the Plaza Health Network with a number of homes, especially in Dade County. What do you know about the presence of your homes on any priority list?
I don't believe that nursing facilities in Dade County are considered to be priority. As I said earlier, I do know that hospitals have to be number one, but it wouldn't be so bad if the nursing homes could be number three or number four. The point is that some of my facilities did not get put back on the grid until 7 days after the hurricane hit. So there's an issue, but the most important thing is that all of the skilled nursing facilities that you've asked about, that Florida reports on, that the Agency for Healthcare Administration reports on, have to meet the Agency for Healthcare Administration's responsible guidelines and requirements in order to pass inspection. We go through very, very intense inspections on a frequent basis. And this is part and parcel. Emergency preparation is one of the things that we have to meet.
Final moment here, Elaine, and I know your time is tight as everybody's is here as we prepare for this. For our audience in South Florida, part of the preparation, if you've got loved ones in these facilities, what should someone who has a loved one in a nursing home or assisted living facility, what should they be asking of the facility today and tomorrow in preparation for the storm?
Number one of the requirements in preparation is that you contact family members and let them know that everything is in order. So that's already been done probably by all of the facilities in Dade County, but if not, it's being done today and tomorrow. And that's part of the checklist. But what people should be asking is whether your facility has all the fuel that's required, whether they have the ability to keep the patient cooled sufficiently, and whether your staffing is as is required. We have wonderful people work in these nursing homes. They really give so much of themselves, and they come in, the Team A people come in at the point when you determine that you're close to the hurricane, and they stay for as many days as it takes to get past the storm, and then they go home.
Yep, a lot of folks in many different industries on those Alpha teams and Bravo teams gearing up here. Elaine Bloom, thank you for spending your time here on this Friday with the Florida Roundup, the CEO at Plaza Health Network, and Katie Swatowski, our reporter in Broward County with WLRN via Skype. Thanks to both of you. Got plenty more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. We're going to switch gears a little bit, move away from hurricane conversation for a moment, talking about how Florida courts are changing the way that they deal with and prosecute some marijuana cases here in the region. That's next when the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. We continue monitoring the hurricane, but we also wanted to talk here about some big changes announced this month in how police and prosecutors deal with minor marijuana cases. Sorry? Now that hemp is legal in Florida, Miami-Dade and Broward County prosecutors have changed how much marijuana someone will have and be accused of carrying before they'll pursue charges. Palm Beach County's prosecutor in July, for instance, said the smell of marijuana by itself is no longer probable cause for a police search. Now, how big are these changes? How big are they for carrying weed illegally in South Florida? How does this change the judicial process, the prosecutorial process, for that matter? Maybe you have an experience with all of this. Share that with us, won't you, at 800-743-WLRN. Marijuana and changing laws, or changing practice of laws, at least in Florida, 800-743-9576, or text us 786-786-7636. Danny Rivero of WLRN is back with us here on the Roundup. So what spurred these changes, first of all, Danny?
So there's been a couple things that have happened both at the federal level and at the state level to get us to this point. The farm bill, not too long ago, federal farm bill legalized hemp, and then Florida shortly after followed suit, legalizing the sale and cultivation of and possession of hemp. Now, the thing about this is, if you look at it side by side comparison, the differences between hemp and marijuana are really at a molecular level. So you might be able to look at both of them side by side, and you can't tell which one is which. The conundrum is for police and the courts, if you're looking at both these things and one of them is legal and one's illegal, how do you determine which is which? And so there's really two areas where the rubber hits the road on this. One of them is for being searched. Mm-hmm. Basically, some police departments have given guidance, and prosecutors' offices have given guidance to say it's no longer reasonable cause to probable cause, I'm sorry,
right,
to search someone from the odor alone, because now the odor might be legal.
Yeah, the so-called smell and search or sniff and search is no longer the case.
Exactly, because that person might have, in fact, a legal substance, and you're not, they're not in violation of any law. So the smell alone is one thing. The other thing is for actually getting prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So if the changes that have been announced by several prosecutors' offices, as they say, if you are in possession of a small amount of marijuana, we're not going to prosecute it. And the reason is because they have field testing, but the field testing is not 100% accurate. There is very accurate testing that can differentiate between the legal and the illegal substances, but it's very expensive and they haven't caught up to it. So they're saying in the meantime, we're just not going to prosecute.
So how significant are these changes?
There's thousands of arrests. And just to contextualize it, this is adding a piece to some discretion that was given to different police agencies. Miami-Dade Police, Broward County Sheriff's Office were in the last few years given discretion to issue citations for small amounts of marijuana. They did continue making some arrests for it, but for very small amounts of marijuana, some of these new changes that have been announced is that they're just not going to prosecute it, period.
Wondering for our listeners' audience, what questions do you have about this? I know we're in the midst of storm preparation here, talking a little bit about some interesting news as it relates to marijuana and the kind of legal ramifications of the changing space that marijuana is in Florida. 800-743-9576. That's our voice line again, 800-743-9576. Or the text line, if that's better for you here as you're running around preparing everything, 786-786-7636. The text line, 786-786-7636. Judge Samuel Sloan is along with us from the 11th Judicial Circuit Court of Florida here in Dade County. Your Honor, welcome to WLRN. Thanks for spending your time with us today.
Thank you. A pleasure to be with you.
So how significant from the bench are some of these changes that have been announced within the last couple of weeks, for that matter?
Well, the changes are extremely significant. And just, if you don't mind, at the outset, if I could take a moment to clarify what the state of the law is so that your listeners are not confused. Marijuana is illegal under federal law, period. There is no exception for medical marijuana. If you're in possession of marijuana, it's a crime.
A federal crime.
A federal crime. Under state law, recreational possession of marijuana remains illegal. Medical marijuana, there is an exception for under the state law in Florida. However, it's not recognized under federal law. So it's very important for someone to understand, for example, if they have medical license to have marijuana in Florida, it becomes a problem once you move outside of Florida and you could be subject to prosecution. So the law itself has changed, interestingly, but as you've noted, when Florida legalized the cultivation of hemp, how the courts operate and how the police now operate has dramatically changed.
The direction that we've seen from prosecutors are regarding prosecutors. What direction in the judicial branch on the bench have you been given, if any, at the 11th Circuit?
Well, I oversee our county court misdemeanor division, which handles misdemeanor amounts of marijuana. And of course, I've alerted them to the hemp statute and that now what was a clear-cut case of what people thought was cannabis is not clear-cut at all, because both hemp and cannabis come from the same species of plant. And therefore, it looks identical, it smells identical, and it feels identical. So many of the issues that we will be dealing with as judges deal with issues where the defendant is trying to throw evidence out of court, claiming that the police had no right to stop them or to search them because there's no longer this plain smell doctrine where if you smell marijuana coming from somebody, you in essence had the right to stop and search them.
So what is that further impact on the evidence requirements for prosecutors that you and your colleagues on the bench will be looking at?
Well, you can see that many prosecutors' offices now recognize this particular issue. And what they've determined is the difference between hemp in illegal marijuana is the THC level.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And therefore,
and if being hemp has a low THC level,
0.3%, it cannot be any higher than 0.3%. Right. So
over that, it becomes marijuana.
It becomes illegal.
And if you don't have your medical card, it's you're carrying it illegal in the state of Florida.
That is absolutely correct. So it presents such an interesting legal issue for prosecutors. Is the prosecution of a misdemeanor case, which is extremely minor, is it worth the cost of analyzing the substance at a lab, which we currently don't have here, I believe, in the state of Florida, according to the Miami-Dade state attorney, to analyze that substance? And not only do you have to analyze it, you may need an expert to come into court and to testify. So when you're looking at the cost to the prosecutor's office, and should I say to the taxpayers right. of the county and the state, then you start to wonder, is this really all worth it?
Your Honor, we got a lot of calls and questions about this issue. Danny Rivero, our reporter here at WLRN, is along with us. Judge Samuel Sloan from the 11th Judicial Circuit Court of Florida in Dade County, overseeing the misdemeanor court, essentially, talking about all these changes and pun intended, the cloudiness around hemp and marijuana in the state of Florida and some of the changes in how prosecutors are dealing with minor amounts, small amounts of possession. We'll start in Fort Lauderdale, where Michael is on line one. Go ahead, Michael. You're on the radio.
Hey, good morning or good afternoon. How you guys doing today?
Doing well. Go ahead.
So quick question. As an end user, recreational cannabis user who is not necessarily a medicinal user yet, am I to be worried? You know, I'm not saying I'm going to go ride around however I feel with this substance, but if I, you know, if it comes down to I'm getting pulled over and I have a small amount of marijuana on me, but I am not a medicinal user as of yet, am I to be worried of being prosecuted? Or is this something, you know, with your previous guest that you're talking about, the cost and everything, that's something that might blow over?
I can guess to the judge's opinion of this, but I'm going to ask you just a quick follow-up, Michael. When you're talking about carrying a small amount, you want to give us a sense of what that is?
Maybe a gram of cannabis.
Okay.
Maybe, you know, something small.
Okay. Well, first of all, let's take a note that you indicated you're from Broward County. Is that correct?
Fort Lauderdale, yes.
So it's important for the listeners to understand. The prosecutor's office in Broward is handling these cases differently, apparently, than the prosecutors in Miami-Dade. The prosecutors in Broward apparently are still going to prosecute cases above 3 grams. They're not indicating they will not do so. Let me put it that way.
Why is 3 grams an important threshold?
Well, I don't know why they chose to use 3 grams for their particular threshold, but I can tell you as far as Miami-Dade went, they are not going to be prosecuting, apparently, any misdemeanor level, which is 20 grams or less. That amount, the Dade County office is not going to handle. Broward apparently, according to the news release, drew the line at 3 grams. I'm not sure why they chose 3 grams.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'll mostly leave it to the judge, but I mean, ultimately, it technically is illegal. I mean, I can't give anyone. I'm not an attorney.
Right.
So you're running a risk no matter what you're doing. But a lot of it does depend on the jurisdiction. There's something I wanted to add.
And let me just add, it also depends on the officer. So keep in mind, it is illegal, and an officer has options to either just let you go and toss it away. In some jurisdictions, the officer could give you a civil ticket instead of a criminal charge, which is very common in Miami-Dade, and we can talk about that in the future. Or, in essence, the officer could choose to arrest you. And the decision whether to prosecute is a different decision on whether to arrest. So always keep that in mind.
And one thing I wanted to add to just this conversation is part of the reason that prosecutors have arrived to this is to protect people that are doing nothing illegal. If you're riding around and you have hemp, and you get pulled over, and they decide to take you in and take you through the process. You know, there's a saying in criminal law. It's you might be able to beat the charge, but you can't beat the ride. Well, which means you can maybe in court later on prove, hey, this was not marijuana, this was hemp. But in the meantime, you get dragged through the process.
Yeah,
you get taken in. You might get booked. You might have to spend a couple days in there, possibly.
And on the hemp side, it doesn't matter if it's 3 grams or 20 grams or 20 pounds. It's hemp.
Yeah.
It's legal.
Yeah, it's hemp. It's legal.
Another question here from Miami Beach. Kathy on line two. Go ahead, Kathy. You're on the radio.
I appreciate this. I just want to bring up an area that doesn't seem to come to the public's notice too much. If you were on probation for a criminal offense and you test positive for THC, even if you have a medical marijuana card, you still will violate your probation. Similarly, if you are in child welfare court and you have a medical marijuana, you know, card and you test positive for THC, you are again in violation. The law says that you cannot be sanctioned civilly or criminally for the use of your medical marijuana. But because it's still illegal federally,
yeah,
and because the judges have the discretion, they very quickly make the determination that you're abusing a legal drug.
Kathy, so, it's an interesting point there. Let me put that to Judge Sloan here. What about that conflict that appears to be present? And we were talking earlier about officer discretion, judicial discretion here in the cases that Kathy's talking about.
And it's not necessarily judicial discretion at the threshold. It's a prosecutorial discretion on whether to proceed on a violation of probation. When somebody alleges a violation of probation, the probation officer files a document claiming that probation has been violated. It's up to the prosecutor if they choose to proceed on that. So while technically she may be right, again, prosecutorial discretion is really going to be at the threshold, which makes it very important.
I'm struck about how much dissonance there is here. I mean, Your Honor, you started by talking about under federal law, marijuana is illegal. Full stop.
Full
period.
Stop, period.
Doesn't matter what kind it is, why you have it, or how much it is. But in state law is a little bit different. And then, of course, now we have prosecutorial discretion. Kathy's experiences with probation, the difference in amounts of officer discretion, or what prosecutors will deal with in Dade County versus what they may deal with in Broward County. Danny, there's just a lot of dissonance when it comes to marijuana and hemp.
I mean, I don't know if there's any other area of law that's as confused as this particular area of law. Just look across the country. It's not Florida alone.
No.
Even though now in Florida, we have 67 counties. You might cross the county line and they have a different policy than where you are now. There's no across the board way that this is being handled. There's very little guidance given. An interesting thing on this topic of kind of confusion in North Florida, the attorney there, the federal attorney, has announced that office with federal prosecutors is going to start stepping in and prosecuting some of these very small marijuana arrests using help from the Drug Enforcement Agency to verify them, which is a very interesting. I've never heard or seen anything like that. I mean, a very small marijuana possession charge is very rarely prosecuted on a federal level.
Right.
It's usually a local. I've asked our Southern District Attorney here, Ariana Fajardo-Orshan, I've asked her office if they're going to do anything similar. I've given no indication that they are.
Mm-hmm.
So even at the federal level within the state of Florida, you have different districts looking at this differently.
Applying the law in a different way. Your Honor, we got one more question here in Hialeah. Jose on line 3. Go ahead, Jose. We got just a couple minutes left.
Hi, I just had a really quick question. I know that you guys are talking about prosecution in terms of different counties and stuff, but I was curious to see specifically Miami-Dade County, how they would, how it looks like in terms of oils and edibles, right? So if somebody had a small amount of oil, which can, you know, THC oil and CBD oil looks very similar and smells very similar, what the process looks like if it's the same as flower and how they would treat that.
Jose, we got it. Judge Sloan, how about it? Edibles and
well,
CBD oil.
Jose, fortunately, I'm allowed to say with all honesty, I am not familiar with consuming edibles or oils, and I'm not sure how they are handled. And I will state that on the record. I will say that medical marijuana, however, which we have discussed, it is illegal to smoke medical marijuana. So there is...
Wait, let me time out there. Is that accurate? Illegal to smoke if you have the medical marijuana card. In March, State Department of Agriculture approved flower for sale, but it's vaping.
Vaping is different than smoking.
Okay, all right.
And so that is an interesting issue that still needs to be addressed.
I see.
But
okay.
They specifically excluded smoking.
I see. Okay. All right. Real quick, just back to the edibles question here, Danny, and the CBD oil. Part of the gray area the judge is talking about for him exists because there's really few regulations, if any, regarding CBD oil sale, possession, or for that matter, edibles.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And since the state hemp law was passed, the State Department of Agriculture has started the process to figure out how to regulate the sale and consumption in edible form and other things of CBD and hemp-derived CBD products.
Yeah, lots more questions here. Danny Rivera with WLRN, Judge Samuel Sloan of the 11th Judicial Circuit Court. Guys, we're going to get back together after the storm, after the aftermath, because lots of questions about this area. Really interesting conversation. Thanks to both of you. Always appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Katie Swatowski and Denise Royal. Our Director of Radio Programming and Technical Supervisor for this program, Jason Sabka, Richard Ives, Peter J. Meritz, our Director of Radio Operations, Alicia Zuckerman, our Editorial Director, News Director Terrence Shepard, Tracer Furtado, our Digital Director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, texting, and stay tuned to WLRN for the latest on the hurricane. This program made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.